help you out with – we try to apply our knowledge and our experience to helping you build a nice balanced portfolio. You know, you'll see situations where people will have it's kind of funny. The glass half full, half empty. You'll see people that will have 85% of their portfolio over – you know, I just talked to a guy the other day. 85% of his portfolio was up over 20% in 2 or 3 years. And 15% of it was flat. And he just kept talking about the 15%. And then I finally pulled up his invoice and I realized that I said, well, you got 85% of your portfolio is up 20%. Why are you focusing on the 15%, you know? And then you got other people that'll be just totally focused on the 85%. They won't see the 15%. And that's the nice part about being balanced. You know, using selective hindsight in investing is pure foolishness. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's irrational, it's unreasonable, and it's a skewed perspective of reality because you look back and there's people that will literally, you know, hold themselves, hold others accountable for, you know, well, you built this portfolio and only 85% went up and this went down. Why didn't we do all this? I've literally had people ask that numerous times. I'm like, well, you never know. That's why you balance it out. And so we focus a lot on getting numismatic items into deals now. There's some incredible value. The market has cleaned itself up to where, you know, it pretty much applies to everything. I mean, my wife and I have been to, like, you know, the international antique shows in Miami and things like that. And I deal in cars and stuff like that. And the quality always pays. The good stuff always gets better. And junk always stays junk. And a lot of people think junk because they think they're getting more for their money. Well, when we build a portfolio, we're going to put junk in there. Junk silver, you know, as people call it, US 90% or whatever. We put in barterable, you know, survivalist type stuff if you get into trade situations, which, you know, to a lot of people, that's like, it sounds ridiculous. But throughout history, it's happened time and again. There was an interview today I saw online or on the news with apparently the new head of cybersecurity for Homeland Security. And he was discussing the fact that China is by far our greatest threat, that they're absolutely stealing all of our intellectual property, that they're behind the vast majority of these major breaches of huge credit card companies. And like I've discussed, credit reporting agencies and, you know, Target, Shopko, Amazon, they're getting into these companies, even Microsoft, they're getting in and they're getting all this information. And these companies have vulnerabilities and they're not, it's not like someone, you know, think of it this way. Think of a company like Microsoft is a huge fortress. Okay. They've got walls that are 140 feet high of solid concrete and the city of Microsoft lives within those walls. Well, people always think of hackers as somebody who can find a hole in the wall. There's no, that's not how they do it. What they do is there's people passing through the gate all the time of that wall. And they, what they do is they will compromise an individual. They will actually find people, for example, at a hackers convention a few years ago, which sounds bad, but these guys' job, these were hackers that are primarily, their primary purpose is to protect large corporations. And so they want to know all the cutting edge stuff, right? They want to know the dirty stuff. And so one of this guy who did this video on YouTube, he actually, and I may have mentioned this before, but he hacked into the telephone of the director of cybersecurity for Microsoft. He hacked into her telephone. And then he tracked her everywhere. He was able to access all of her files, able to access her laptop, everything, because everything's integrated. He did a little speech on stuff, and he kind of presented what he'd done. Not any kind of, he didn't compromise any of her personal stuff, but he just showed. And of course, she lost her job immediately. And he said he didn't feel bad about that because everyone has Microsoft all across the United States. Across the world. You know, we were down in Mexico, Barra de Navidad, which is about 50 miles north of Manzanilla at a nice hotel we used to go to a lot down there, the Grand Bay. And it's beautiful. It's on a 1,200-acre private island kind of thing. And very inexpensive. And Bill Gates had just been there with his yacht. And he had gone into Barra de Navidad and the whole, the whatever the state was down there, I don't remember. And he had donated free computers, free Microsoft software, everything. He just went and gave free to everything to the whole school system. And they were just absolutely elated, you know, by all that stuff. They were so happy, and they were, when, you know, it was a good time to be an American down there, I'll tell you that. But, you know, that's how far everything permeates. It's just everywhere. Microsoft is everywhere. You know, everybody wants it. Everybody has it. And so this guy didn't feel too bad about it, because if the head of cybersecurity was so sloppy and loose with her own personal security, how could she – how could we feel safe, you know, with our information with Microsoft? So, you know, there was a big debate over the ethics of it. But the truth was, he never compromised her stuff. He just showed that he could. And that just has given you a basic understanding of where we're at in this world. I think I've discussed this here recently, and we've got to be, you know, you have to be so secure in financial issues. You know, metals work. They're private. They're anonymous. They're immediately transportable. Nobody knows you have them. They don't have a serial number. They're not traceable. They're not trackable. There's, you know, they don't even set off metal detectors, frankly. That's why they'll let you wear your, you know, gold jewelry through the metal detectors at the airport. I do it all the time, and it doesn't set it off. And I actually, years back, carried 20 ounces of gold through one time just to see. And of course, it didn't trigger it. So because it's a non-ferrous metal. And those are not gold, you know, the metal detectors aren't like the metal detectors you go across the ground with. They're not gold detectors, which maybe they should be, I don't know. But it's a good thing to have a nice nest egg built up in solid assets. If you put, you know, a nice basis of precious metals and some good coins and tuck them away, you're going to have assets when people pass on, and you can pass it on to your heirs without any records, or, you know, you can keep things quiet. You can hand it over. There's not 1099s. Keep it out of probate, all that stuff. It's got a lot. There's a lot of advantages to precious metals. There's a lot of items that we sell that are legislated, non-reportable. There's no 1099 reporting when you sell them, et cetera. A lot of people are afraid when they're buying stuff that they're, you know, getting their information reported to the government. Not the case at all. Not the case at all. So absolutely confidential. We don't ever have your Social Security number under any circumstances. And the only time we get, you know, fairly specific in your information is when you rent a safe deposit box from us, because we want to be able to protect you and make sure that if anything ever happens to you, anybody can locate that only by knowing it's here. It's not recorded or reported anywhere. So, you know, if you have a box with us, make sure someone knows. You get two keys. We keep a guard key. We cannot get into your box under any without drilling it, which is very blatant, and changing the locks so you'd know we did it. We did that on purpose, so there's absolutely no question of our integrity in the preservation of your rare items or valuable wealth and things like that. If you want to get set up financially or have a portfolio built, I don't care if it's savings. We do 401ks and IRAs, all that stuff. You can just give us a call, 444-0044, or toll-free 877-TAP-COIN, and we'll be happy to take care of you. We do a good job with that, and we will. And everything's wholesale. It's not something you got to think about. People are, oh, I got to think about it. You're not buying an investment with metals. You're basically transferring into what God calls money in the Bible, which I've gone over numerous times. God calls it money. It is money. What we carry now is not money. It is a promissory note from a private corporation. That is all you have, backed by nothing. And then it is backed by something. It's backed by debt. And people are like, I don't understand how that works. And it's so, they've made it so convoluted because it changes hands so many times that they've made it so counterintuitive that you can't follow it. And so that's by design. And what it also does is makes money for people all along the way. All these bankers are killing it. they're just killing it. There's, I think it's like 12 or 13 steps. And I was going to get that going, even though that wasn't what I wanted to cover today. I wanted to pick up where I left off on Monday, and I'm trying to find information here. Well, the problem is you get a lot of this liberal socialist garbage on the internet that isn't very good. It's more trying to justify it than it is trying to tell you what a farce it is, and the history of it is really pretty bad. All right, so on Monday, we were talking about socialism and how socialism fits into America and how it doesn't. And I think I'd like to kind of pick up on that a little bit. And I'll go over, I had five reasons that I jotted down why socialism is not a Christian form of government. And I kind of buzzed over those. I'm going to re-highlight them again. Basically, we've got, I started out with a Barna poll that said more Americans think Jesus would prefer socialism than those who believe he would prefer capitalism. Why is that? It's because people don't read their Bible. They don't know. They don't know the spirit of the Bible. They don't know the spirit of the law, the spirit of God. They just have little quips and qualms about Jesus. They see Jesus as a hippie, just this love-spreading hippie dude that came down and nothing mattered to him. And he, you know, give you everything because he didn't have anything. And all of his apostles were other hippie dudes. There's so many people that think of Jesus this way, man. They're like, Jesus is love, man. That's what they think. And it's like, yeah, no, God is love. But love is an action. Love is not a word. Love is not an emotion. And that's where we start to really get off course. Love is, you know, discipline. Love is punishment. Love is training people up in the way they should go. Love is letting you struggle through trials and tribulations, which work out for your best, you know, as it says in Romans 8:28, of those who love him. That's love. And so they have an improper perspective of it. Loving your children is making them equipping them or preparing them to be the best citizens they can be. Loving your children is not showering them with undeserved gifts. It's not letting them sit in front of a video game 3 or 4 hours a day or the TV or watch trash or, you know, be able to go in their bedroom and leave the door locked for, you know, 6 hours while they have a room full of electronics. You cannot anything. If you've got kids that are locking, you know, themselves up and they're on the internet or anything like that for hours, I promise you anything you can imagine is occurring. That's just reality. It's right there. It's like being stuck, you know, downtown in a bad city and you're just walking street to street and eventually it's coming at you. So you just need to realize that you have to have boundaries and you have to have control. There's different filtration systems. There are different tracking systems you can put on it. And if the kids object, then, you know, you got a problem. So, and it may, you know, it may be uncomfortable to do now, but I'll tell you what, it's a lot less uncomfortable than having your child end up with, you know, a completely failed life and radical immorality and all the things that come with that. So it's pay me now or pay me later. Be strong now or be strong later. So we've got this new thing, this millennial thing, where we've got 57%. This is dated, when's this article written? 2016, we were up to 57% of Americans under 30 prefer socialism over what they call democracy. It says here that 69% of those under 30 said they would be willing to vote for a socialist president, presidential candidate, or other candidates. 69%, 70% basically, 7 out of 10 millennials are willing to vote socialism. Why do you think they go after that crowd for the votes? Why do you think they want all these illegal immigrants coming in? There's a good reason. I mean, they know they vote illegally. They're going to get them to vote soon. And I'm just telling you, folks, if we get any of these people in office, it has gotten – there's no shame. There's no God in their lives. I don't – you know, they it's kind of like in 2 Timothy where it says they have a form of godliness or piety but deny the power thereof. This is what they are. They'll stand there. I've heard Nancy Pelosi and I've heard Hillary Clinton. Well, I don't know that I've heard Hillary Clinton mention God, but I've heard Nancy Pelosi mention God. And yet her perspective, she's extremely wealthy, terribly wealthy. And she will talk about God and act like she's fighting for the the underlings, the lower populace or the working class or whatever you want to call it. And everything she does hinders it. It's a lie that's on the grandest scale where they deceive. They say they're helping the poor, and everything they do destroys the poor. Just like I was talking about your children locking themselves in a room. You know, do you want to just feed them whatever they want? What are they going to ever get out of that? It's the same with society. What you want, all these social programs. Well, you've got the desire to be elected is contrary to giving people what they want. So they basically are making decisions or making promises based on political expediency. They aren't looking out for the best interests of the people. The thing is, they'll fight for it. They'll get some of it, but the rest of it, it'll never occur. I mean, there's so many empty promises that they give. It is unbelievable. You get the Elizabeth Warren, just cuckoo birds. But, you know, if somebody has no spiritual insight, they can't see it. And you can tell in probably, I'd say, 8 out of 10 cases, a conservative versus a liberal on TV. You just turn your volume off and guess. And I think if you've got spiritual discernment, you'll see it. Because most conservatives are, they're indwelt by the Spirit, I believe, the majority of them. I've met some that aren't, but the majority are. So anyway, we've got this strong push going on in America, okay? And the problem is we've got, like I discussed last week or Monday, and I'm going to go over this real quick. One of these people, they just don't even understand how we've gotten to where we're at. The millennials are weary. They don't trust the system. I get that. They've witnessed these consistently declining economy under Obama. Now they've seen it come back under Trump, but the media is, I mean, I saw a thing the other night where all these media people are begging for a recession. They want, Bill Maher, totally immoral, but all these other anchors on MSNBC, CNN, they're begging. They're saying they want a recession. Their financial analysts are reporting and predicting a recession, saying, well, it wouldn't really be that bad. And it's all because, like even Bill Maher said, he says, I want a depression to get Trump out of office. He's basically saying, I want all the Americans to suffer because I hate our leader because I didn't get my way. And he got elected and it wasn't my choice. And it's like, we need to stand behind the garbage and vitriol that comes out of the mouth of the American public towards Trump is so much worse than anything that Obama ever saw. And Obama created it. I mean, he exacerbated it with his speech. But so these people, the kids have seen the fall of the Twin Towers, filled with tons of legitimate conspiracies. We live now in, I would say, the most partisan eras in American history. We've got these never-ending wars, that started predicated on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that were never found, and they probably did exist, but we never found them, or maybe they didn't. I don't know, but they just wanted to take Saddam out. Our political system definitely needs reform, but socialism is not the answer. It may sound compassionate and Christian to have a socialistic government, but it's antithetical to everything Christianity teaches because there's a difference in God's commands to a nation versus an individual. And you have to realize that God treats nations different than he does individuals. And so, we've had this, people don't even know the history of it. I'll maybe brief you on that a little bit. The birth of cultural Marxism in America started with what's called the Frankfurt School. So, the 50s were kind of a simple romantic and golden time in America. We had, suburbia and California beaches, and Atlantis shrugged. The book came out. We got NASA going. You had Elvis, you know, all that kind of stuff. The baby boomers and the nation stood atop of the world in every field. It was an era of great, you know, economic prosperity in the land of the free. And then we started to see the roots of Western culture decay at a deep, deep level, which first sprouted a century ago. People don't realize it began with a loose clan of ideologues inside Europe's communist movement, which is known as the Frankfurt School today, and its ideals have perverted our society. They have, you know, they're deceptive liars. They brought this Frankfurt School to America, and they started to infiltrate our culture with cultural Marxism, they call it. They say when outcomes fail, just change the theory. So before World War I, Marxist theory held that if war broke out in Europe, the working – this was Marx himself. He said, "If when war breaks out, the working classes will rise up against the bourgeoisie and create a communist revolution." Well, you know, as was the case with much of Marxist theory, things didn't go too well. When war broke out in 1914, instead of starting a revolution, the proletariat put on their uniforms and went off to war. You know, the working class went and fought – for their country, not against it, which was completely contrary to Marx's ideal. And then after the war ended, Marxist theorists were left to ask, why were they wrong? So, you know, these two prominent Marxists of the day were this Gramsci and Lukács. I won't get into those too much, but they both concluded that the working class of Europe had been blinded by the success of Western democracy and capitalism. Why would it blind them? Because it's contrary to Marxist teachings. They reasoned that until both had been destroyed, a communist revolution wasn't possible. So these guys were both active in the Communist Party, and their lives took different paths. One of them got jailed by Mussolini, and then earlier, one of them became... Anyway, he oversaw this Bolshevik revolution and whatnot. So Marxist theories, they started to lecture this stuff all around. They had graphic sexual matter being presented to children. They were starting to teach all this loose sexual conduct, and Marxist theory had failed to take hold in the real world. The people were outraged, and then we get the birth of cultural Marxism. So basically until 1923, when the cultural terrorists turned up for a Marxist study week in Frankfurt, Germany, these guys were... You know, they were getting set up and they were getting things ready to go. They started mixing ideas of Sigmund Freud, those of Marx, and then came up with cultural Marxism. And when they came to America in 1934, the school was reborn at Columbia University. Imagine that, one of the most liberal schools in the nation. And its members began to exert their ideas on American culture. And at Columbia University, the school honed the tool it would use to destroy Western culture, the printed press. And Columbia became the pinnacle journalistic school in America. And they started to put out top journalists. You start watching, you know, go online, do research on the top journalists in America, liberal, of course, and they all come from Columbia. You know, there's conservatives come out of other schools, obviously. Some conservatives come out of Columbia. I think even Glenn Beck might have gone there. Obama went there, supposedly, although there's only one witness who is Iranian and back in Iran. And there is a guy a while ago who was supposedly graduated with him and never saw him, but so be it. So Columbia University started to publish a lot of popular material, what they called critical theory, which is a play on semantics. It's the theory, critical theory, what they called it, was simple. It was criticize every pillar of Western culture to tear it down. Family, democracy, common law, freedom of speech, and others. And they hoped that these pillars would crumble under the pressure. Next, they put out a book called, by Theodore Adorno, The Authoritarian Personality, which it redefined traditional American views on gender roles and sexual mores as prejudiced. And this is all the stuff we're dealing with today. People don't realize all these seeds that we're dealing with today were started by like FDR in our government. And it's a runaway train. It takes time to get the moral decay buried deep into the system. You have a lot of these kids, mostly girls for a long time, that were put in these secret societies, and they get paid incredible education, you know, all the way through law with an area of specialty. They get these jobs deep in the government, which John Boehner was talking to me about one time when he was the Speaker of the House. And he said there was nowhere they could go to research any of this, the scandals, because they'd already planted these people all over and you couldn't get anywhere. And they would disobey all these freedom of information requests and make things string them out. And the thing is government workers, they have, you know, they deny these FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act, and then they don't have any consequences. There's no consequences. It's like it says that they must, you know, provide this information, but it doesn't say what happens if they don't. So there's no penalty. There's no consequence. So they just abuse the system. Obama was a classic. I mean, there's a certain level of morality and conscience that we should have in the Oval Office. And when you do not have that, or you have a majorly skewed perspective of it, which is like Islamic, this whole system crumbles. I've mentioned over and over, like John Adams and Monroe's claims, that this has to be, our system has to be rooted in religion and morality. Otherwise, it will not last. So these guys knew that, and they knew how to take it apart. It's basically, they're being led by the devil. Why would they want to tear this down? Why, you know, jealousy, hatred, just, demonism, I don't know. So the go-to slur for the politically correct today is fascist, right? The school pushed its shift away from economics and towards Freud by publishing works on psychological repression, and their work split society into two main groups, the oppressors and the victims, and they started this divisional, you know, biblical thing where Christ said a house divided among itself will fall. They argue that history and reality were shaped by those groups who controlled traditional institutions, and at the time that was code for males of European descent, white males. And recently we've heard even that Omar, whatever she is, who's was married to her brother, and you know the gang, the squad of four that are, you know, all basically minority Muslims that hate America, and they say that white males are the real terrorists in this country. This stuff's all coming to fruition, generation after generation. This stuff's getting embedded deeper and deeper to the point where these people can pour in our country. People are coming into our country that trash talk our country. They can trash talk our country on the way in, get a visa, or illegally jump the border, never go through citizenship classes, you know, go to our colleges, get free education paid for. When I was in college, I worked one summer for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I had an Iraqi and an Iranian next to me that were both working on their PhDs in agriculture. And on the U.S. government's dime, they were at war with one another. And I said, what's with you guys? You know, you're like best friends and your countries are at war. And they said, well, we're brothers in Islam. But when brothers fight, but when it comes to the great white Satan, we unite. And I was like, what's the great white Satan? This is clear back in the early 80s. And they're telling me America's a great white Satan. I said, then what are you doing here? And they said, well, if your country's going to hand out money, we're going to take it. You know, they admitted it to me. I was like, wow, I was pretty shocked, you know? So this is what we're doing, is we're basically doling our money out across the world, and we're feeding our enemies, we're educating them, we're building them up. You know, sure, in some cases we build relationships with them, but for the most part, it doesn't seem to pay off too well when the money stops flowing, does it? And so I'll try to buzz through this. There, you know, they've got this coalition of victims. You know, these two guys I told you that set up the Frankfurt School, they went back to Germany after World War II, and then another one stayed, and they, you know, they wrote books. They started to put out all these books that argued that Western culture was inherently repressive because it gave up happiness for social progress. They had polymorphous perversity, which was a concept crafted by Freud. The social movements of the 60s, which we all saw, this book, you know, was basically the precursor to that, to the 60s. Everyone read it. It would replace, you know, they wanted people to replace the working classes, the new vanguards of Marxist Revolution. And the author of this book, Marcuse was his name, believed it would be a victim coalition of minorities, blacks, women, and homosexuals. So the social movement of the 60s, black power, feminism, gay rights, sexual liberation, gave this guy, It says he fueled it, and it gave him a unique vehicle to release cultural Marxist ideas into the mainstream, which railed against all things establishment. The Frankfurt School's ideals caught on like wildfire across American universities. So this, it was the build up in the, you know, the building of the foundation, and then '60s was the real opening of this intolerant mindset of tolerance, or whatever you call it, which was a book in '65, Repressive Tolerance. The same guy published again. These were going crazy. It was here that he coined the term liberating tolerance, which called for tolerance of any ideas coming from the left, but intolerance of those from the right. See, no one will write that. Well, yeah, I suppose they will now, but now we know it. We see it. One of the overarching themes of this Frankfurt School was total intolerance for any viewpoint but its own, which is also a basic trait of today's political correctness believers. Again, Columbia University is at the heartbeat of this stuff. And this guy says, logic is not independent of contact. So, long story short, here we go. Recalling the words of Winston, a different Winston, not Winston Churchill. The Frankfurt School's work has had a deep impact on American culture, and it's recast the homogeneous America of the 50s in today's divided, animosity-filled nation, which has contributed to the undeniable breakdown of the family unit, as well as identity politics, radical feminism, and racial polarization in America, which makes it hard to decide if today's culture is more like Orwell's 1984 Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. I don't know if you've read those books. They're kind of key. They were both commissioned by what was called the Fabian Society, which they come across as fiction novels, but they were blueprints for the future. George Orwell's 1984 predicted right where we're at, you know, where they have thought policing and politically correct speech and all this stuff. They called it newspeak. And of course it is newspeak. There's things you can and cannot say, and that you were being watched all the time, and people started to get arrested and taken away based on what they were saying and thinking, not on actions. And that is completely contrary to God, because only God knows what we're thinking, and he doesn't punish us until we do, for the most part. There are exceptions, but he knows our heart. Man does not. And then Aldous Huxley's A Brave New World was this homogeneous uniformity that he predicted for the future. Well, both of these, in other words, men and women become uniform, and women start to look like men or dress like men, and men dress like women. And, you know, it's completely contrary to God. God created Adam and Eve. So the world, Satan has to take it away. And this is all coming from this Frankfurt School. And there's a lot more information. I tried to kind of pick up a short synopsis of it, and it's maybe not that thorough until you know more about it. But, you know, they thrive on what they call populist trends. The political establishment in America, it fully embraces the ideas of the Frankfurt School and pushes them on American society through public miseducation. Our kids are getting taught this stuff, and it's getting inculcated, ingrained in them. And that's where, you know, I've said recently that we're complaining about a generation that we raised. Well, you may not have raised your kids that way, but you know, they're in schools, and we're not monitoring them properly, and we weren't really that well educated in what was going on, and we didn't understand the agenda. The agenda is very dangerous, and it's always the Christian that is the liberated mind that is fighting this stuff, so they get a bad rap because they put a lot of pressure on Satan, bottom line, on evil. So Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, were the beacons of progressivism, and they're both major disciples of Saul Alinsky, who was a devoted cultural Marxist, right? So now we live in a hypersensitive society in which social memes and feelings have overtaken biological and objective reality as the main determinants of right and wrong, okay? These kids are trained to be offended, to have false offense. It's basically false pride, and that's biblically warned against. They're filled with false pride. They want contention. They want division. They want enmities and strife. So, and then to quote that Winston from before in Orwell's Dystopia, he said, freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. Today, America's not free. Common sense doesn't stand out like that, which is quite interesting when you really think about it. It's pretty It's pretty concerning, I guess, from my perspective. I think I see it kind of coming along, but or progressing far more rapidly than we've seen in the past. You know, I've got all this crazy stuff here on Ocasio, but last week or Monday, I was talking about socialism is giving they give the kids a sense of entitlement. And that's what really drives all this stuff. So then they say you're entitled, and then they bring in socialism based on materialistic worldview that, you know, like I said, according to Bernie Sanders, the greatest problem in the world is unequal distribution of wealth, which betrays a fundamentally materialistic worldview, which is based, you know, that's the basis of socialism, Marxism, and all that exists is the material world. It's godless. We've discussed that. I've discussed that. So that completely contradicts Christianity and affirms the existence of both a material and a non-material worldview as a believer, and teaches that mankind's greatest problems are spiritual and that the greatest cause of suffering is sin and salvation is found in the cross. So, second, socialism punishes virtue, right? You don't want to stand out. You don't want to be an overachiever. If a guy sitting next to you is doing nothing and you are just an all-star, outstanding performer, you get paid the same. So what happens? Who changes there? Does the guy that sits around and reads magazines all day change? Why? He gets the same paycheck. The guy who's the overachiever has no incentive to perform. That's what socialism does. It dulls you down. It steals your talents. That's what the devil wants. Every person has a somewhat of a destiny built into them. They have a set of skills and talents and abilities. And I saw a thing recently about a kid by the age of two. He just demanded a guitar, demanded. And first they got him a kiddie guitar and he said, no, I want a real guitar at like a little over 2 years old. And at like two and a half, he's making music and he's singing. He was in his family wasn't a musical family at all. He just had it in him. God placed it there. God does this on earth. He gives us all these wonderful talents, and socialism wants to anesthetize you, take you away. You know, what socialist country has there ever been prosperity for the masses? They die of starvation. It tears them down. It's a way for the devil to get in and destroy God's greatest creation, which is you and me, and our ability to think freely, free will thinking, and to choose God. I mean, it pulls people away from God. It makes man their God. Government becomes their God. These people end up being tortured, punished, and killed for a belief in God. I have a friend who's done tons of clandestine ministry in China, and he's in different provinces with different emperors or whatever they are. He's seen, or you know, whoever leads the provinces, he's seen horrendous things happen to people that you wouldn't even believe, and I wouldn't even repeat on the radio. For being believers, because they believe it's a mental illness. Socialism is nothing more than stealing. It's stealing people's talents and abilities. It's stealing people's accomplishments. When God, you know, if you're faithful little, he'll give you much, right? Well, you can't, you know, be given much in socialism because they take it all away. God can bless you, then you hide it. Now you're breaking the law, which is kind of interesting. And they have to be, you know, they say people with more money have to help those with less money. Well, you know, yeah, this is what a biblical mindset is, but that's an individual basis, not a nation basis. The government that was formed in this country was designed to be so small that it teetered on anarchy. And it just covered your basic rights, and it gave you the ability to flourish. And then the states were like individual nations that could develop all the laws they wanted underneath the umbrella of the Bill of Rights. And you could literally vote with your feet. If you didn't like the way one state was run, you moved to a state you liked. And if they got filled up and they got more taxes, you know, people be more desirous. But then they come in with all these federal programs, federal highway, federal education, you know, federal emergencies and you know, everything, infrastructure, and until they completely contain everybody and control it. 501c3s for a nonprofit. When churches get a 501c3, the government's starting to tell them what they can and can't say from the pulpit, and tells them that they cannot, that a pastor cannot speak about his political beliefs from the pulpit. And so pastors do this. And I've heard, you know, pastors will say, well, you know, it doesn't matter who you vote for, just get out and vote. And yeah, it does. I mentioned that here recently. You know, I heard Obama in his speech. Ooh, that's nice. In his speech before Trump won, beat Hillary, he said there's no such thing as a worthless vote or something like that. And he's right. You know, everybody's got a vote. And that – nice. I got a mic problem here. But there's no such thing as a worthless vote. And you've got to get out there and you've got to vote and voice your opinion. Because if they tell you your vote's worthless and you don't vote, then you've probably heard them speaking to their own constituency – sorry about this – to their own constituency telling them how important it is that they vote. And they swing elections this way by marketing hardcore and getting people out, illegal votes and things like that I've mentioned. So Obama defended his socialist policies, I said, to a little girl by saying, we've got to make sure that people who have more money help the people who have less money. If you had a whole pizza and your friend had no pizza, wouldn't you give him a slice? And, you know, the girl's like, yes, and it's really cute, but that's not at all what's going on here. Well, it is, but it's not an individual decision. It's imposing these beliefs upon us. So socialism encourages envy and class warfare, division. Christ talked a lot about this. It's all designed. This Saul Alinsky system, you know, Saul Alinsky and his Rules for Radicals, he glorified Satan. He said Satan was the ultimate rebel. That he had and he got his own domain, you know, he got rewarded, he says. That's the way he sees it. Saul Alinsky presents it that way, which isn't exactly the truth. He's going to get his own domain in the end, and it's going to be very, very hot and very miserable and completely separated from the God who created him. And, you know, it's so deceptive. So, you know, we've got, I said, Bernie Sanders posted on his Facebook page, let us wage a moral and political war against the billionaires and corporate leaders on Wall Street and elsewhere whose policies and greed are destroying the middle class of America. And people eat this stuff up. I don't know why, but they do. So he's basically mimicking Karl Marx, who viewed history as a series of class struggles between the rich and the poor. In fact, Proverbs 14:31 says, whoever oppresses the poor shows contempt for his maker. And I believe in that strongly. And I don't think there's another scripture that says you don't oppress the poor for money, which sounds really foolish. It's like, how can you oppress the poor for money if they're poor? Well, because what little they have, they're not the wisest you're going to run into, and they're easy to dupe and persuade. And so we're not supposed to take advantage of that level of ignorance that they have, and we need to look out for them and help them. And I apologize again, this mic thing is not good. So, and the last, socialism obviously seeks to destroy marriage and family, and because it wants to break it up so that we lose all of our religious and spiritual roots. We, you know, they have to take that away and bring us to a point where they can control individuals, because the parents have such influence on the children. If you've ever seen The Killing Fields in Cambodia, the movie, it does exactly that. They get into the schools, they get these kids, and they get the kids to turn on their parents. And this has happened in country after country. Karl Marx says, give me the schools and give me the media and the rest of society, I will control. And he just says, give me the children and give me the media. And that's all. And what are they doing in America? This stuff's being propagated through our school systems, our federally funded school systems, and our media. Our media is so radically left, our founding fathers would have never, ever thought of this, right? You know, George Washington, I mentioned in his departure speech, warned against a two-party system. I mean, he could have spoke on anything. But he warned us against a two-party system. And you might say, what's that got to do with what you're talking about? Well, he basically talked about how it would create these political factions that would ultimately tear our nation apart. He could speak of anything. And this country got started. It was just getting started. And then in his farewell address, he chooses, you know, he says, I think this is a quote from him. Let's see here. However, political parties may now and then answer popular ends. They are likely in the course of time and things to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards their very engines which have lifted them to unjust domain. And he's warning the American people against the negative impact that opposing political parties will have on this country. There's actually better quotes than that. During his presidency, he witnessed the rise of the Democratic Republican Party in opposition to the Federalists and worried that future political squabbles would undermine the concept of popular sovereignty in the United States. Little did he know how bad it would get. He had foresight. He had wisdom. He had visions of the future, phenomenal visions, and maybe he was given some insight that he didn't want to come out with just because he, you know, might have sounded a little weird. But he was so opposed to it. His thought in what became known as his farewell address in the spirit of party serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms. You hear that? False alarms, fake news, right? What they call red flag events, things like that. It kindles the animosity of one part against another and foments occasionally riot and insurrection. And now we've got Antifa. You know, I don't even know where they stand. You know, anti-fascist supposedly, but far from anti-fascist in my book. And we have the 10 planks of communism. There's not a lot of time left. What's new? And you've got, so when Karl Marx describes his Communist Manifesto, he gives in his Communist Manifesto the 10 steps necessary to destroy a free enterprise system and replace it with a system of omnipotent government power so as to effect a communist socialist state. That's his quote. And then, you know, the 10 planks of communism, I'll just go through them briefly without really highlighting. The abolition of private property and the application of rent to public use. So the government owns everything as much as they can, and you have to rent it. It's subsidized. You can't control it, and you have to pay taxes on your property. You never really own it. That's contrary to the Constitution. How about number two, a heavy progressive or graduated income tax? We accept that as, you know, a really brilliant, fair idea. That's communism in its play, and FDR started all this stuff. Well, Theodore began it and FDR finished it. The abolition of all rights of inheritance. We have inheritance taxes. You know, they want to take private property when you die, and the left doesn't believe it's yours. The fourth is confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels. So, you know, all this illegal search and seizure, it's interesting. The Fourth Amendment is against illegal search and seizure, and the Fourth Communist Manifesto, or the Fourth Plank of Communism, is to confiscate the property. So it's completely contrary. We have integrated this into our legal system. We confiscate property to anybody. We don't like what they do. It's confiscated before they're convicted. I bought a house that was confiscated from a situation like that, you know, and I don't know if I won't get into my opinion on that. Centralization of credit in the hands of the state, aka government, by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. Sound like the Federal Reserve to you? Yep. That's why we went from our Congress was commanded to control the monetary system and they handed it over. I mean, I see the Constitution as, you know, one step below the Bible. Our founding fathers, we need to honor tradition, but liberalism destroys that. They that's why they want change all the time. They don't you never hear them worshiping or glorifying traditional beliefs. It's always got to change everything. It's wrong. It's broken. It's all bad people. Everybody's bad, you know, all the time. And they got to stir the pot. And that's how they create. Number six, communist or plank of communism, centralizations of the means of communication and transportation in the hands of the state. Now, remember, Karl Marx wrote this in the 1800s, and he still had the foresight to see that. We've got the FTC, the FCC, the DOT, you know, you go down the whole list, the Interstate Commerce Commission and Federal Aviation Administration and Federal Communications Commission. And I mean, there's so much of it. They control everything. You can't do anything without their authority. Number seven, plank of communism, extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state, the bringing into cultivation of wastelands, the improvement of the soil, generally in accordance with a common plan. So basically the EPA. all these national forestry things and Bureau of Land Management and Bureau of Mines and National Park Service and even IRS has control. The Department of Commerce and Labor, the Department of Agriculture, you get the picture. They control it all. You know, everything has to be to their likings or you don't do it. Equal liability, number 8, equal liability of all to labor. Establishment of industrial armies. And especially for agriculture. Well, we got a country now, you know, we've got Social Security, social welfare scheme that takes the place of, you know, strict liability like in Exodus 21, which I don't have time to read, and individual responsibility and that violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. Some call it income redistribution, but the Bible calls it covetousness and theft. Again, look at Exodus 20. It's pretty clear, 15 and 17. This and other social programs have enslaved us and future generations with a horrendous amount of national debt will never be repaid. We're, our total deficit debt and everything now is over $1 million per person. Can't be paid back. We're done. We have the. You need a two-income family just to put food on the table. I mean, this is what he wants. You're forced to work. You have no choice. The 9th plank of communism, his thermostat to see if a society is practicing communism. Combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries. Gradual abolition of the distinction between town and country by a more equable, he says, distribution of the population over the country. I don't know if you've seen Agenda 21 where they want to, you know, push people here and push them there. And we've had in Spokane, you know, anti-sprawl laws and which actually made it worse. And they're trying to control people's movement, where they go, what they do, how they do it. Obama tried to prevent Boeing from going to South Carolina. You know, that's all part of it. The government's just, it's power. They want to tell you what to do. And number 10, I don't think you'll find this odd, is free education for all children in government schools. And then they say abolition of children's factory labor in its present form, combination of education with industrial production. So these are government forced tax funded schools. And essentially what they're doing is they're saying, oh, you don't want your kids working on the farm. You don't want them out there. They outlawed it. Why? So that you can. So they have to go to these schools. They have to be brainwashed. You've got, you know, from Bernie Sanders to Hillary Clinton to Elizabeth Warren, communist influenced lawmakers are increasingly calling for free education for all. Free education for all. That's the communist way. Whether it's the Department of Education, NEA, the National Education Association, outcome-based education, the Marxist agenda is in all of it. So I just think it's important that you understand where we're at, how far we've come. Can we get it out? I don't know. I just think it's important to know. You know, people want to put their head in the sand. How far are we from full-blown communism or full-blown socialism? Is it that much? Isn't it a matter of time before one of these people gets in office or they get control of all three branches? And now they're going radical, radical, radical? I mean, these leaders, they're getting old. They're very wealthy. And they don't care. They're paying capital gains. They're like, hey, you go get all your income tax. You pay a ton because they want to bankrupt the middle class. They want control and power because they take money out of the government. And they see the government as a vacuum of your wealth and your ability. And that's communism at its source. So it is integrated in our community. You need to be aware of it. I think we're teetering on the edge. Trump is a final overriding factor or resource. That's what his name means. Maybe our last call. I don't know. I can't tell you. But I can tell you Ezekiel 38, I was reading a lot about that with Iran and Iraq and Syria and Saudi Arabia, all that stuff. We are definitely looking at end times, folks. So once again, I appreciate you tuning in. Thank you. You can do a Google review for 1 5-star, 1 free silver dollar. Go Google, Bing, and like Yelp, 3 5 stars, $2. Take care. God bless. Bye-bye.